This is a download from the BBC. To download other programmes or for more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
Hello, good evening. You're listening to 5 Live. I'm Simon Mayo.
And I'm Mark Kermode.
Very good. You almost forgot your cue.
No, I knew exactly who I was.
So here we are at an unusual place. It may well be that people are watching this live online on Friday afternoon,
yeah,
at 25 to 3.
Because it is actually 25 to 3 in one version of the world.
That's right. So there will be people who are watching this saying, can I text you and can I email? To which the answer is yes. However, if you're listening, because it's after 9 o'clock, can I text and email? The answer is no, because we've already been and done it.
So if you want to text or email, ask yourself this question. Is it dark outside? If the answer is yes, then you can't.
And if you're listening on a podcast, clearly the answer is always no.
Yes.
Some movies that are going to be reviewed include these.
They include Precious. We had the director Lee Daniels on the show last week. Edge of Darkness, Mel Gibson's return to the big screen. Adoration, the Atami Goyan film that premiered in Cannes, not the last Cannes, the one before that. And The Princess and the Frog, Disney returning to hand-drawn animation.
Should we start with the box office top 10?
Let's start with the box office top 10.
We have lots of emails and texts which are coming through the week. Thank you very much indeed for those. Number 10 is A Profit,
which I think is great. Topped many critics' polls as best film that the critics saw last year. Obviously coming out this year, up for a number of awards. It's up for a foreign language film, BAFTA. Extraordinary central performance by Taha Rahim as the eponymous prisoner who is set upon by Corsicans, told that he has to commit a murder, and then essentially discovers who he is or isn't whilst in the confines of the prison. It's political, it's a crime thriller, it's metaphysical, it's really gripping, and it is a terrific piece of work.
Paul and Mel in Brighton say, Dear Sam Bell and Sam Bell, having heard the Good Doctor's review of A Profit last week, my partner and I decided to splash out and visit our local independent cinema, the Duke of York in Brighton.
Oh, which is a very nice independent cinema.
Where we upgraded to the balcony sofas.
Ooh.
How about that? That's great. You would pay, wouldn't
you? You would.
To be on the balcony sofas. Having been a long devoted listener to your show, my partner listened with me for the first time in the car last week, and on hearing the review, I turned to her and said, Kermode doesn't praise films like that often. I could tell within 45 minutes of watching the film, my other half wasn't interested, as she kept fidgeting and asking if I was enjoying it, to which I replied, so-so. Another 45 minutes later, she was asleep, and for the first time in years, I was looking at my watch.
She was asleep?
I gave up caring about the story and characters and only stayed as I'd spent £20 on tickets. The film was slow, boring, and I was completely uninterested in any characters or plot. At the end of the film, my better half summed the film perfectly up by saying, that was torture. I couldn't have agreed more. We weren't the only ones either. As we left the cinema, I could hear people saying boring, and also what a waste of money that was. I failed to hear anyone say anything positive. I couldn't stop thinking on the way home that the Good Doctor thought this was already a potential film of the year. My advice for anyone going to see this is to take matchsticks in order to prop open your eyes.
I'm just astonished. I mean, you must have gone to see a different... Is there another film playing at the moment called A Prophet? Un Prophet? Did you go and see something else? Was it some strange... No. I mean, I don't even know where to begin. It's just none of those things, and I'm genuinely staggered.
A couple of emails on the same...
Have you had any other emails saying the same thing?
No, not saying it's boring and terrible.
Oh, fine.
Joe at the University of Leeds, BA in Japanese and Italian, and Henry Walker, also in Leeds,
yeah,
saying, making the same point, went to see A Prophet last night, thought it was excellent. However, I couldn't get past the fact that the Corsican gangster boss looked exactly like Anthony Worrell Thompson,
yeah,
the celebrity chef.
This, yeah.
I kept expecting him to whip up some scallops in a white wine sauce or a nice bit of sea bass, rather than bribing guards or ordering hits. It's very distracting.
I imagine that Anthony Worrell Thompson isn't a well-known figure in the country of that movie's origin. But yes, a couple of people have said that. It hadn't occurred to me because I'm not really au fait with TV chefs, but I have subsequently looked up a picture of Anthony Worrell Thompson, and he does indeed look like the Corsican gang boss in The Prophet.
It's a good laugh moment.
It is.
So,
and there are few of them in A Prophet.
New entry at 9 is Brothers,
which I think is fine, but nothing more than fine. The problem with it is that it's, you know, good, solid performances. It's kind of directed in workmanlike fashion. It's the story of two brothers. One goes off to war. One is a reprobate, stays at home. We think that the one who's gone off to war has been lost, and a relationship begins with his wife and his brother, and then events take their course. I mean, it's just odd because it's fine, it's, you know, solidly done, but it is melodramatic, and it seemed much more contrived than the European original. It's one of those weird things, and I did wonder at the time whether, is it simply because when it was in a foreign language, it didn't seem to be as creaky as it does now that it's in English? I'm really not sure what the answer to that question is.
Dan in London says on this email, during his review of Brothers, was the Good Doctor being dry and ironic when he claimed that he had never thought of Tobey Maguire and Jake Gyllenhaal as looking similar before? They're practically separated at birth contenders. Next, he'll claim that his good self and Robbie Rotten from Lazy Town are not from the same gene pool.
What's Lazy Town?
You've got children and you don't know what Lazy Town is.
No, what is Lazy Town?
It's a kids' program.
And is there somebody in it who looks like me?
Yes, Robbie Rotten does look awfully like you.
There was a picture in the one of the tabloid newspapers this week, which was me and Stephen Baldwin, that said separated at birth. Not Alec Baldwin. I hastened to add Stephen Baldwin. I don't know what Lazy Town is, so I can't tell you.
I think the DVD is required for Dr. Kermode.
Okay.
It's a strange program indeed. Daybreakers is at 8.
Which is, you know, perfectly fine. It's a good, solid, romping vampire movie with some a certain amount of gore in it, not quite enough to get it over into the 18 certificate, and much better than I expected it to be. I paid to go and see it at the cinema, and it was perfectly fine.
The Book of Eli is at number 7. I should say we had...
Lots of correspondence.
Quite a few emails, but each one is all about stuff which basically... it's about the twist. It's about the twists and changes, and they're all plot spoilers. So I'd just like to know that, despite our reputation, I'm not reading any of them out because they are very substantially about big twists in the film.
Okay, well, so, you know, essentially, it is as has been said before. It is a similar movie in theme to The Road, which is a superior film. That it's post-apocalyptic or apocalyptic worlds, we have to refer to it. There is a guy on the road walking towards the coast. In the case of the Book of Eli, he's called Eli, and he has a book. The identity of the book is something of a mystery, but I have to say not very much of a mystery, which is what I imagine is what you're talking about in terms of the plot spoilers. I like it in as much as it's a Hughes Brothers movie, and there is always stuff in Hughes Brothers movies that feels individual, that feels strange, that feels distinctive to them. Obviously, it's nowhere near as good as their finest work, which is Dead Presidents, which I think is one of the great overlooked movies of the 90s. But there was plenty in it that I enjoyed, not least... a machine gun toting Francis de la Tour, which was worth it just for that alone. But it has—I don't think it's been very well critically received.
You mentioned The Road, which is at number 11, so it hasn't been included in our top 10 countdown. But this from Mike in Bath on the subject of The Road. My goodness, that was tough going. Not sure I'd call it entertainment, despite the small glimmer of hope. It was pretty relentlessly bleak. I also found the whole apocalypse scenario a little unconvincing. What could possibly have happened to wipe out all animal and plant life, except Viggo Mortensen and son? Plus extras. I know you'll say it's not really the point and it doesn't matter, but I couldn't help be distracted by it. Does the book offer any explanation?
No, it doesn't. Funnily enough, one of the things that the film does, which is completely truthful to the book, is that it is left open. I mean, when I was interviewing John Hillcoat, I said that what I believed was that what had happened was a natural catastrophe, but one which had somehow been precipitated by man's intervention. And he said, well, that's exactly what I thought it was. So that I thought was the general sense that somehow something natural had happened, but we had somehow encouraged it to happen, but it is specifically left unclear. It's not said like it's nuclear war or anything like that. Somebody just put in front of me a picture of somebody with a huge chin and a quiff who I imagine is
Robbie Rotten.
Robbie Rotten
from Lazy Town.
But that is an artificial... I mean, he looks like Jay Leno. Is that an artificial chin? That's not his real chin, is it?
Well, it's makeup, isn't it?
No, it's not. Yeah, but it's makeup. It lies on your face. That's clearly built onto his face. Mm. That's like when they did the TV movie of The Late Show, and the person who played Jay Leno did play him with a stick-on chin.
I'm going to get you the box set of Lazy Town.
I'll look forward to that.
Toy Story 2 in 3D. Only, is it 6?
Yeah, only come back into the cinemas in order to get us ready for Toy Story 3D. Toy Story 2, Toy Story 1, Godfather 1, Godfather 2. You know.
Simon Mira, MA Cantab, MSc PhD. Yeah. This is to add to the debate on the merits or otherwise of 3D films. Last weekend, I took my four-year-old to the cinema for the very first time. We went to see Toy Story 2, shown obviously in 3D. This was also the first 3D film that I'd been to see.
Retrofitted 3D, not designed in 3D. We have to make sure that...
Stop it.
No, but it's important.
And my personal opinion was much the same as The Good Doctor's. The 3D didn't really add anything to what is already a wonderful film, and in some places, I thought it detracted from it. Have you got it in front of you?
I could tell you
know what's going to happen in the email.
Yep.
The really telling opinion, though, was that of young Tom, age 4, mm-hmm. who after seeing the film said, Daddy, next time we go to the cinema, can we not go and see a 3D film?
Very good.
If the 3D effect can't wow a four-year-old with no prior experience of the cinema, surely they are on a hiding to nothing.
Well, Roger Ebert said something about 3D, which was very sensible, which was that the problem with 3D is it keeps drawing your attention to little bits of debris floating in the corner of the screen and takes your attention away from what you should be looking at, which is what the characters are doing. There was also a cartoon in Private Eye last week, which was a cinema hoarding showing something in 3D, and the characters underneath were saying, sadly, the characters are still two-dimensional, which I felt must have been a nod to Wittertainment.
Number five, by the way, we don't have to break for travel because there's no travel at this time of night.
No, but we will break for news at this time of night. Because travel stops, as we all know, when it gets dark.
That's right. And even though this is being recorded,
yes.
So we'll just leave a gap for the news where the news should come.
And just to be clear again, if you're listening and it's daylight, you can text.
Yes, as indeed people are. So, for example, Simon says, needless to say, the onliners find the off-screen chat just as entertaining as the chopped-down version.
Very good.
Paul in Newport, this is surreal stuff. I especially like the off-mic conversation with Colin Firth, which was just as entertaining as the interview. If you missed that, that's going to be going out next week, which is great. Can all shows be like this in future? Dear Bubble and Squeak, really enjoying the bits in between the proper bits. True wittertainment. So maybe we just need to be unedited completely.
Yeah, we do.
So where are we? Number five, it's complicated.
It's not complicated. It's dreary and boring and not as funny as it should be. And I'm amazed that it's been received as well as it has. It's just, you know, it's one of those artificial American comedies in which you're meant to find it empowering and thrilling and uplifting, and it's actually incredibly turgid.
Now, up in the air is at number four, David Heffernan in Dublin. Regarding the Good Doctor's view of Up in the Air, I think, but that, can I just say, just ahead of this, there's a degree of plot spoil in this, but not really
Okay, Up in the Air, just for the George Clooney movie, which is fun.
Yeah, bit of a mobbly thing.
Yeah, George Clooney plays George Clooney.
Regarding the Good Doctor's view of Up in the Air, I think both he and some of the listeners have been somewhat harsh to the movie. I agree that there is a move in the tone of the movie from dark to light, from cynicism to the sentimental.
Yes.
And had the movie ended on that note, then I would, like you, have dismissed this movie as being one of those films where the trailer voiceover man would say, sometimes the journey is more important than the destination or something.
Well, that's very good. That's very good.
However, the movie does not end in that way. There is a certain tragedy, I may be overstating it, in a central character who realises that the life he has been living is empty, but having realised this, is trapped in that life. In a way, he is worse off than he was at the beginning. He has gained some self-awareness, but cannot escape the choices he has made. This is far from being a smug Hollywood ending where everyone ends up learning and growing so that they move on happier and stronger.
Can I, without giving anything away, and I'm not giving anything away any more than Who's Driving the Boat, it ends up with him looking at the destinations board, and he's I'm sorry that's the moment of
with blood dripping from one arm
and a rocket launcher over his back. Yes, fine.
Alvin in the Chipmunks, the Squeakle, it's still there at three,
and it's still not as good as Alvin in the Chipmunks the original, and we have that from the horse's mouth.
Sherlock Holmes is still at two.
Guy Ritchie's best film. He didn't have anything to do with the writing of it, which is probably the key to it, but it is well directed and a very funny central performances by Robert Downey Jr. and Jude Law, who I think are on cracking form.
The UK's number one is still Avatar. Steve Brindle says, being parents of two under fives, my wife and I are careful about the films we choose to go and see at the cinema. Being an average sort of family, obviously there's not much point in waiting for Avatar to come on TV, as when it does, we will most certainly not have a 3D television and the spectacle will be lost. So babysitter arranged, we went out on Friday night. I thought it was Pearl Harbor awful.
Which is a very, that's really...
It's a good phrase.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Worst film I have ever seen at the cinema, says Steve. IMAX in 3D is great for wonderful visuals, and they do lovely, interesting, and culturally enriching documentaries to go along with them. I saw a great one at the Science Museum about the moon a few years back. Looked stunning and had an engaging narrative to go with it. Avatar, he does the dances with walls in space line again. No matter how great it looks, it is a film that has no worthwhile narrative, is in no way interesting, and was not engaging. It is truly awful. In fact, just because it's 3 hours long, does it automatically make it a film? I've seen better episodes of Ben 10 with my four-year-old. I was bored, and so was my wife. The Emperor has no clothes.
Okay. I mean, I think there are many things wrong with Avatar. I do think it has more spectacle fun in it than that's giving it credit. And I know several people who have seen it. I do still think it has the wow factor. I think it has the wow factor in 2D, though. I think that the issue there is the 3D, but it is clearly overlong, overwritten, and clunkily played.
My word, would you look at the time? Because yes, it's either pushing on towards 3 o'clock,
or
it's pushing on towards 9:30. How about something
Edge
new,
of Darkness,
please? How about Edge of Darkness?
Yeah, I mean, last year we had State of Play, which was an American big screen adaptation of a BBC TV show. And you remember that David Morrissey came on and he talked about how what happens when you have a long TV show and then it comes into a film, and he wanted to stay away from it because it sort of felt. It felt like it would be despoiling something beautiful. And obviously what has to happen is that you have to simplify the plot.
What he said was, it would be a bit like going to the wedding of a girlfriend who you're still in love with.
That was the phrase he used, exactly. That was much, much more elegant than what I just said. So now we have Edge of Darkness, directed by Martin Campbell, who actually helmed the original TV series, taking the reins for the rehash, which moves the action of Edge of Darkness across the Atlantic and necessarily takes 6 hours and strips it down to just below 2 hours. So now we have Mel Gibson, who hasn't had a major lead, well, hasn't had a leading role. He's turned up in little sort of cameos, but hasn't been properly on screen since, it must be, M. Night Shyamalan Ding Dong's Signs. Remember Signs?
Yes.
Yeah.
Vaguely.
Yeah, so since then he's been behind the camera, obviously, The Passion of the Christ and Apocalypto, which I thought was fun, although clearly the work of somebody who's completely mad. He plays, in this case, the cop, I think is the correct American term, whose daughter comes home and then is gunned down in his house. They believe, initially, that the gunman was looking for him rather than her. He is, of course, completely distraught and tips over into the edge of darkness, in madness to some extent, in his desire to wrong this terrible, to right this terrible wrong.
As by doing a wrong.
To
right the wrong.
Two wrongs do indeed make a right. Perhaps aided, by Ray Winston's character, who, when we first meet him, we're not sure which side he's on.
Creeping up on a bereaved man in a murder scene is not very bright. Mr. Craven, we have things to talk about.
Like your name and what you're doing here?
Like who shot your daughter.
You know who shot my daughter?
If I was looking for a man that might have shot your daughter, and I had a limited imagination, of which I do not, I might have looked at what you found today.
The known killer.
The unusually well-known killer. Makes you think.
Why are you here?
Your daughter was flagged as a possible terrorist threat to the United States of America.
So, as I said, the film's directed by Martin Campbell, who most recently revitalised the Bond franchise with Casino Royale, and in fact, to whom I warm even more, because there was an interview with him recently in which he had said that with Quantum of Solace, Bond completely lost its way, and I agree entirely. I think Casino Royale really did put things right then. I do think Question of Sport was just totally all over the place. Because interesting thing,
as we said at the time.
And of course, interestingly, now the next Bond movie is going to be helmed apparently by Sam Mendes, which is an interesting choice, because it's Sam Mendes known for character dramas rather than action adventure. What Campbell does is a very solid workmanlike job with something which is essentially a very unwieldy project. Firstly, because what happens in the original is obviously the conspiracy plays out in a much sort of slower time frame, and yet what they attempt to do is to get all the significant things into the 2 hours. So effectively what happens in that 2 hours, and I'm not going to give away more of the plot than you need to know, is that Mel Gibson character very quickly discovers that his daughter is involved in a bizarre series of corporate interwranglings involving plutonium and nuclear, not nuclear weapons, nuclear power, although again, as Martin Campbell said, plutonium ain't what it used to be.
What about unobtainium? Unobtainium.
Did you know somebody sent an email saying that unobtainium is in fact a scientific term? They didn't make it up. There really is something called unobtainium, and it is a generic name for a particular form of things which are, I suppose, unobtainable. But unobtainium, apparently we were all laughing at James Cameron, apparently there really is such a thing. I don't care, still a stupid name. The problems are this.
Can I just say, on that very subject, James Dacey, he talks about unobtainium being stupid. He also says, and why the humans would think it's a good idea to go meddling with the natives on a planet called Pandora.
I know. Although that does remind me of the Reese Ephens line from, Notting Hill. I knew a girl called Pandora once, and you can fill in the rest of that thing. Anyway, so... Well, let's do the plus side first. Mel Gibson does have that quality on screen of somebody who is on the edge of you know, insanity. It's just, it's something that he does. I mean, he's a very contradictory character, and, you know, you read stuff in the press about him that makes him, you know, you think he's one thing, he's another thing. What we know about him is that when you put him behind a camera, he directs in a very visceral fashion. I mean, Passion of the Christ, whatever else you think about it, is a, you know, well-directed film that is a effectively a full-on gory horror movie. Apocalypto is a really extraordinary piece of work. I mean, I really think Apocalypto is something because it's so nuts and it's so nihilistic and it's so full-on, but it's a very, very cinematic experience. So obviously, when he's getting, you know, in front of the camera now, he's saying to the, you know, to Martin Campbell, fine, you get on, you direct the film, I'm going to do the thing which I do, which is acting. And yet there is still something of that kind of intensity about him. I mean, whatever else may be true of Mel Gibson, you put a camera on him and he looks like somebody who's about to explode. And that quality is what the central character needs. The problem is that the story is pulling in two different ways. On the one hand, he's a kind of down-at-heel schlubby cop who, as a result of this terrible thing that happens to his daughter, becomes somebody else. On the other hand, he is Mad Mel, Mad Max, and there are kind of action sequences in which he does the thing for which we know Mad Mel, Mad Max. You know, he's the guy that you don't mess with. I mean, I don't know whether you, have you seen the trailer for Edge of Darkness?
I've seen a version of it.
There's a bit in the trailer in which one of the characters says, you know, the guy you're looking for is armed and dangerous, and Mel Gibson says, what do you think I am? And you can think, that's it, that's the movie. You know, the very beginning, the whole setup is in the trailer. He's there, they kill his daughter, he's angry, and he's going to get even. Underneath all that, you have all the conspiracy thriller stuff, which clearly has dated since the origins of this story. I mean, funnily enough, if you look back to that Mel Gibson movie, Conspiracy Theory, do you see that?
Mm-hmm.
Which I thought was really good fun. I mean, the idea was his central character was one of these nutso conspiracy theorists, but it turns out that some of the conspiracy theories that he believes in are actually true. And that film's at least 10 years old, maybe 12 years old now. The idea now that what he uncovers is that within this great corporate structure and within this, you know, industry which is tied up with, you know, nuclear and you know, all that stuff that we always think of as fantastically sinister, is somehow corrupt and strange, isn't quite as shocking as it used to be. Plus, of course, the minute you see Danny Houston wearing a suit in any film, you think he's bad. Do not, you know what you said, the thing about an education, don't get into the car with Ed Balls. Danny Houston turns up on the screen. He did it, Your Honour. Clearly, because it's Danny Houston doing that incredibly, fantastically smarmy thing that Danny Houston does. So, on the one hand, you have a thing which is meant to be a story about an ordinary guy discovering a web of intrigue and lies and deceit and therefore teetering over the edge of darkness. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you have something which is much more generic, which is a story about they killed his daughter, now he's going to get them, you know. And the two things don't ever quite come together. Also, as you probably know, the character which is played by Ray Winston was originally apparently going to be played by Robert De Niro, who did something like A Couple of Days and then decided that they would part company because of, you know, artistic differences. And Ray Winston stepped into the breach. And Ray Winston is great. I mean, I would watch Ray Winston in pretty much anything because he has real kind of screen heft.
Heft is a great word.
But I mean, you know, what I mean by heft is, like, you know, he is a weighty presence and he can do that the thing which that role needs, which is he is this kind of monolithic presence who on the one hand is scary, on the other hand it has these really kind of peculiarly philosophical lines about Greek mythology in between, you know, the running and shooting. So it's a film which is pulling in several directions. It's also a film in which all the source material appears to have been, you know, massively overcrammed to get it through those 2 hours, and so consequently it doesn't have the depth of the original, and it looks like it's pulling in different ways, and it looks like everything is squeezed in too tightly. But that said, it's done in an efficient enough way from the directorial point of view, from the helming point of view, that actually you sit there and go, well, it's a perfectly fine, passable thriller, which is given a spark by the fact that Ray Winston is a great screen presence, that Mel Gibson does exude the edge of darkness. I don't know what it is particularly about him, but he does have that kind of teetering on the brink quality. And everything zips along fast enough that even though you kind of know exactly where it's going, it's doing it fast enough that you kind of let it get away with it. So despite all the things that are wrong with it, and there are many things wrong with it, it is still a perfectly serviceable workaday thriller that moves.
Dominic and James in Rugeley going to the cinema tonight. This made sense in the afternoon bit of this show, but clearly it's getting late, so maybe it's the midnight showing or something. Two films. Which one to see? Book of Eli or Edge of Darkness?
Well, actually, see, that's difficult. Edge of Darkness is a better film. Book of Eli is a more interesting film. Because
one or the other?
Edge of Darkness.
Dear Mr. Darcy...
That was really horrible to make me do that.
I'm doing it on behalf of the listener. 1 minute before the news and sport, by the way, just in case you know, because really, clearly it's coming up to 9:30 in the evening.
It is.
Dear Mr. Darcy and Mark Darcy off Bridget Jones, saw Edge of Darkness at a preview screening. It's about as edgy as a cotton wool sofa in Lazy Town. It has none of the intrigue, none of the suspense, and crucially, none of the subtext of the British TV original.
That's all true.
First state of play, and now this.
Yeah, no, it is true. It doesn't have any of those things, nor does it have the famous kissing scene, which the director said, you know, can you imagine Mel Gibson doing that? No, it doesn't have any of those things, but once removed from the source, which is clearly superior, it is, as I think was true of State of Play, a perfectly functional workaday thriller.
This from Martin Darlington. I cannot let Dr. K's flippant and erroneous comment regarding American pronunciation pass without an attempt at correction. This is from last week. I would agree that there is much to be lamented regarding the American evolution of English, but I thought he would be aware that their word, aluminum, predates our own version of the same word.
Aluminium.
You will no doubt recall that the great scientists of the day gathered in the early 19th century in Vienna to standardise the periodic table, amongst other things. It was agreed that all elements would be given the ending ium. I believe there are now exceptions to this rule, but being a helicopter pilot, says Martin, and not a scientist, I neither know nor care. This led to the change from aluminium to aluminium. As the young USA was still officially at war with Britain, and the Royal Navy were pretty good, the American scientists declined to attend, it seems, and no one bothered to tell them. So in this case, they haven't got lazy or dropped letters. They're just hopelessly out of date. And may I just attempt to redress any offence I might have given to the good doctor by telling him that I recently introduced my 9-year-old stepdaughter to the Princess Bride, with the predictable effect that we now greet each other most mornings with, "Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya."
You killed my father. Prepare to die. Excellent.
To which you should reply, Mowage, and so on, and various other great bits. So you can email and text if you're watching this in the afternoon. You can't in the evening. Tell us something else that's new and interesting, please.
Precious, or Precious, based on the novel Push by Sapphire, to give it its full title. It's got BAFTA nods for Best Film, Best Director, Best Actress.
A nod is a nomination.
A nomination, yes, yeah, okay. As opposed to talk, which is what comes before a nomination.
Talk leads to nods and nods,
yes,
and then things.
And then awards. OK, so yes. A nod is a nomination. An award is an award. Talk or hype is the campaign for it.
Nod, a nod is a really stupid, an Oscar nod. What? I mean, that's just ridiculous.
No, it means the Oscars. No, I think it's a perfectly fine phrase. Keep
well, it's
up.
Just it's a nomination. Well, why not say nomination?
Because nod's got one syllable and nomination's
call it
got
a
four.
Nom, then. An Oscar nom.
OK, let's call it an aluminium siding, all right? And that'll make everything easier.
Dear.
Including Best Actress for Gabori Sidibe and Supporting Actress Monique. The director, Lee Daniels, was on the show last week and it was actually, you know, very, very upbeat considering how downbeat I think the film is. The story is that the central character is a poor black American teenager suffering from hideous domestic abuse. When we first meet her, she is pregnant yet again, pregnant by her now absent father, living with an appallingly abusive mother. Nobody has any faith in her at all, other than a teacher who sees something in her and decides that actually beneath the sort of the really tough outer exterior, there is a vibrant intelligence, which she starts to bring out of the central character, although the hardships do not get better. They simply increase. At certain points, the hardships become so hard that the film actually escapes, like its central character, into flights of fantasy, in which she imagines herself as a movie star attending a red carpet premieres, because the life that she lives is so bleak, so grim, so nasty that she escapes into these fantasies. And as the director himself said in the source novel, if he'd actually attempted to put on screen what was in the source novel, it would have been what in America they referred to as an X-rated film. So he kind of admitted that what he was doing was moving away from the source, because there was simply no way of portraying just how tough it is. Anyway, here's a clip.
There's always something wrong with these testers. These testers paint a picture of me with no brain. These testers paint a picture of me and my mother. My whole family is less than dumb. Just ugly black grease to be wiped away. Finding a job for. Sometimes I wish I was dead. I'd be okay, I guess. Because I'm looking up. Looking up for a piano to fall. A desk, couch, TV, mama maybe. Always something in my way.
Now, the novel came out in the mid-1990s, at which point there had already been sort of several other sort of quite high-profile stories about impoverished, downtrodden African-American life. And the film has drawn criticism from some quarters, saying that actually what it's doing is, firstly, that it's retrograde, it's drawing attention to stories which were old hat even when the novel came out, and secondly, saying that it's a portrayal of those central characters which is somehow racist. You quoted last week a review, which I've subsequently looked up, by Armand White, who had said, "Not since The Birth of a Nation has a mainstream movie demeaned the idea of black American life as much as Precious." I have to say, the review then goes on, and I'm reading this verbatim. "The hype for Precious indicates a culture-wide willingness to accept particular ethnic stereotypes as a way of mainlining status quo films. Excellent recent films with black themes, Meet Dave, Norbit, Little Man."
Ah.
Let me just read that to you again. "Excellent recent films with black themes, Meet Dave, Norbit, Little Man." At which point you think, okay, you're kind of on a hiding to nothing with this argument, aren't you? So, we did talk about this with Lee Daniels, and I think that what he said was that the particular critic in question there wasn't somebody who was necessary to be taken seriously. Having read that second paragraph,
yes.
I agree with that. Also, I have to say, from the film's point of view, I didn't think that the film was guilty of doing the thing that it's accused of doing. I mean, somebody used the phrase poverty porn. I don't think it's guilty of that either. In fact, as you heard from that clip, the central character actually quite explicitly says, "The problem is people look at me and my family and just see us as a problem. They don't see anything beyond it." So I think the film is very aware of those possibilities.
And, you really think anyone goes to see the film and doesn't think that that kind of situation doesn't arise in Asian families or Anglo wherever it happens? It's just an underclass film, isn't it?
Yes, I think it is simply not true. I think that what the film is about is, it is about, at its purest, it is about a spirit attempting to triumph over completely appalling physical circumstances. Now, on the one hand, I think there are things in it that do to them. It's funny because the director was talking about how what he saw it as was uplifting. He saw it as a sort of triumph of the spirit film, and he also said that you should feel perfectly enabled to laugh. Although I have to say, I didn't find many moments in which I saw much opportunity for laughter. I mean, that may just be me, but he was saying you should feel it's okay. There are things in it that are comic, and I didn't see many of them. What I found was this. I think the performances are really great. I mean, I believed all the performances completely, even when the performances are things like Mariah Carey being the social worker, who I genuinely didn't recognise.
Yeah,
she
was
5 minutes in the scene. Everyone's saying, well, doesn't it stick out like a sore thumb that it's Mariah Carey? I mean, I wasn't making it up. I genuinely didn't recognise that it was
and
her.
And Nurse Lenny Kravitz.
Yeah, exactly. Nurse Lenny, who turns
she's
up.
She's not dressed as a woman. Clearly, it's a male nurse, which
exactly.
is what they're talking about in the film. But you don't think,
it didn't just feel like celebrity casting, in that it didn't break the flow of the film for me. Sometimes celebrity casting does do that, but that didn't happen. The real standout performance for me in this is Monique, who plays the mother, who is just terrifying. There is a scene later on in the film in which there is an attempt to suggest, I mean, obviously the mother herself has suffered a degree of abuse that has created the abusive person that she is. I still think that it's stretching a point to say that what happens is that we become sympathetic towards it. It's just that what we see is that behind all the horror and all the rage and all the nastiness, there is something causal. There is something that she hasn't just arrived ex nihilo as this monstrous character, because there are moments in it in which she's kind of the Norman Bates character. She is a really terrifying screen presence. And actually, the most disturbing scene for me, and I mean, you'll remember this because you've seen the film, is there a scene when they're sitting together in this living room, and Precious makes some food, and the mother says, "No, it's not hot. You eat it." And she gets to the scene, and she forces her to eat this food. And there's no real violence in the scene, but it's psychologically, it's just horrible. And things happen outside of that which are more physically violent. But that scene is really, really claustrophobic, and you don't get that kind of claustrophobia by accident. So, from a directing point of view and from a performance point of view, that sort of material is executed very well, and it's very important to understand that that's designed to do that, and it's doing exactly what it's designed to do. My question would be this. I saw the film and I found it hard to watch, because at every given moment, when things look like there is a glimmer of light, the kind of the encompassing horror of, you know, all the bad things that are happening to the central character just keep coming back. And in fact, there is a moment sort of two-thirds of the way through in which you think what's going to happen is that the film is going to obey that movie cliche of somebody managing to drag themselves out of a bad situation and, you know, turn everything to their own ends and it's all going to be fine. But that's not how it plays out. And on the one hand, you say, well, actually, there's an element of social realism. Although actually, it's not a social realist film. It's something different to that. But then something else happens that seems once again to drag the central character back down. So I do have to ask, I'm not entirely sure under what recommendation you'd say go and see Precious, because it is tough. I mean, you've seen it, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is a tough watch, isn't it?
Yes, pretty much all the way through.
And there's a lot of Shawshank and not that much before you get, to the redemption. And even when you get to the redemption, there's still a whole load of Shawshank with it.
Are you suggesting that the redemption is shanked?
What I'm suggesting
is, as you get the redemption,
what I'm saying is, I came out of it feeling really tired. I mean, I don't mean that necessarily as a criticism, but I thought it was a convincingly grim portrayal of a horrendous situation that was played, you know, very genuinely by the performers, that was directed, you know, rather well. Personally, the fantasy sequences for me are kind of emblematic of what's right and wrong with the film. In a way, they're a cop-out. They clearly are a cop-out. They're the film doing exactly what the central character is doing, which is escaping from that area. You sort of felt like, well, that's not a particularly satisfying solution to those problems. On the other hand, every time the fantasy sequences happened, I was really pleased because I felt that I needed to escape from the film in the same way as the film needed to escape from itself. So I don't think it's a bunch of laughs, but it's not intended to be. I'm not sure that it's the uplifting gem that perhaps it has been described as. I think that the predominant thing that I took away from it was a sense of profound sadness and, you know, kind of exhaustion at the litany of terrible things that happened to the central character. Yes, you definitely get a sense of her indomitable spirit, but it is a tough watch that, in the end, I admired rather than, I mean, certainly didn't, you know, enjoy, but I admired the film. But it reminded me of the discussion we were having before about, can a film be depressing if it is good? Because I think Precious is very well made and very admirable. But I did find it depressing.
On behalf of the audience, at what stage is it acceptable in ordinary conversation to use the phrase ex nihilo, as you did about 10 minutes ago? This is the first opportunity I've had to ask.
What do you mean?
You use the phrase ex nihilo.
Yeah, I mean, out of nothing.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering how I could use that in a conversation this weekend.
Well, if somebody has done something with apparent... how can you say it? Say, as in the film, is the mother just a monster who has arrived ex nihilo out of nothing? Or is she something that has been created by the life that she has lived?
Right, so the only context in which I can use it is if I'm talking about the film. There isn't really any other use for the expression.
No, you could say, I was working with Kermode on the radio the other day and I wondered whether his movie obsession arrived ex nihilo or whether he was dropped on the head as a child.
We created magic ex nihilo? Does that work?
Yes, it doesn't quite work, but yeah.
It's just useful. I wrote it down and think maybe it's the expression to use this week.
Why don't you try using Deus Ex Machina, whatever it is, God in the Machine, and then you can play a police record.
That's quite a good idea. I might do that later, or I might have already done that, depending on when you're listening to this. Hugh Collins, listening in New York. In response to last week's verdict on Precious, and indeed what we've just heard, I would argue that the movie is not so much tough as rubbish. The story goes nowhere in particular. Characters wander in and out, seemingly at random. And then two-thirds of the way in, they toss in an AIDS plotline just to show that they mean business. The superb performance of Gabby Sidibe is wasted. Monique never convinces, and at no stage...
Oh, no.
Don't interrupt the email from the listener.
Beg your pardon.
Never convinces, and at no stage does the movie ever seem to know what it wants to be. It's not stereotyping or demeaning, it's just bad.
I think Monique's going to win Best Supporting Actress, and I completely disagree. I think that her performance is really something. I mean, she's a comedian. I wasn't aware, familiar with her work before, but I found her on-screen... And again, look at that sequence. Look at the sequence in which she forces Precious to eat the food that she's made. You don't get that level of horror without having skill. It's very hard to crank the tension in a scene up that well. I mean, for that scene alone, actually, I think the film is worth seeing. I think that sequence of her making her eat the food is really something.
Pete, on this text, if this webcast was in 3D, the good doctor's hands would have us all ducking and diving. Lots of pointy. Very good, says Pete. B-Eng, chemistry failed.
Okay.
What else do we have? How long do we have? Look, it's coming up for a quarter to ten, or a quarter past three. We should. I just want to say, actually, hello to Jason Isaacs and to Jason Isaacs' moustache.
Yes.
We both went to see your thing.
Green Zone, but you're not allowed to talk about it because you signed an embargo.
I signed a thing saying that we can't say what we think of Green Zone, which is the new Paul Greengrass, Matt Damon film. However, I'd just like to say, can we talk about his moustache?
I don't know. I've got no idea how that works out.
Anyway, great moustache.
Yeah, and Jason Isaacs.
And Jason Isaacs.
The credit is and Jason Isaacs.
No, we can't say that. You have just actually revealed part of the film.
Okay.
And to David Morrissey. And David Morrissey.
Yes. That's what we should say. We should no longer
and
say hello to
Steve,
and
Focus, Fairport, and Fairport Convention. And Toby, whoever it was.
Yeah.
Who are we saying hello to?
Toby Jones.
He won't be listening this time of day.
Probably not. No. Can I do a film?
Might as well. Got 15 minutes left.
Princess and the Frog.
Yes.
Return to a hand-drawn animation for a Disney. Obviously, you know, under the control of John Lasseter. I mean, the irony in this, which has been not escaped anybody, is that John Lasseter was the person who effectively brought about the digital revolution with the Toy Story movies. What happened as a result of Toy Story coming along and demonstrating that you could do animation digitally was that in the major animation houses, allegedly, the executives walked along turning off all the light boxes and saying, that's it, there's no drawing anymore because everything for the future is going to be digital. What then happened, of course, is that Lasseter arrives in a position of power in Disney and says, no, you know what? The hand-drawn animation is very, very important. I mean, remember, Lasseter is the guy who effectively made Miyazaki's work popularly known outside of Japan. So now, incidentally, the new Miyazaki film Ponyo is coming up very soon and is really something. So back to classic days of hand-drawn animation. I think this is the first hand-drawn since Home on the Range. Story, which is a kind of twist on the Frog and the Princess, is set in New Orleans. We have a young heroine who, in kissing a frog, which she believes will turn him back into, actually herself becomes a frog. Anyway, here's a clip.
Gentlemen, enchanté. A tip of the hat from Dr. Facilier. How y'all doing?
Tarot readings, charms, potions, dreams made real. Ashidanza.
Were I a betting man, and I'm not, I stay away from games of chance.
Sire!
I'd wager I'm in the company of visiting royalty.
Lawrence, this remarkable gentleman has just read my palm.
Or this morning's newspaper. Sire, this chap is obviously a charlatan. I suggest we move on to a less...
Don't you disrespect me, little man! Don't you derogate or deride. You're in my world now, not your world. And I got friends on the other side.
And then, of course, it goes on to musical numbers. Randy Newman, the voice there of Keith David as Dr. Facilier, who is a genuinely scary, in the right way, Disney villain. Now, I know that I have a kind of romanticization about hand-drawn animation because when the whole kind of digital thing kicked off, when the culture show first started, I did a piece about, does that mean we won't see hand-drawn anymore? Is digital going to completely change everything? And at that point, there were people who were worried that it genuinely was over. Of course, what's happened is that alongside Digimation, which has indeed become pretty much ubiquitous, we have seen hand-drawn continuing to hold its own. We've also seen the continuation of things like Curse of the Were-Rabbit, doing 3D Digimation, physical Digimation, and not Digimation, animation. And so all the different forms of animation have continued to thrive alongside Digimation, which is great. There is something very significant about a company this important going back and giving us a properly hand-drawn, and it does feel like a terribly old-fashioned film. Funnily enough, the thing that it reminded me of most, and I say this as praise, is Don Bluth's Thumbelina. Did you ever see that?
Thumbelina, sort of
Thumbelina,
early 70s.
She's a funny little squirt. Thumbelina,
didn't ask
love
you to
the
sing.
Angel in a skirt. No.
When did that come out?
90s, I think. I mean, it's late or 80s.
Definitely not.
No. Yeah, late 80s or early 90s. It was a really, really good, solid, enduring, well-done piece of art. And funnily enough, there are things about this narrative, because what happens is you essentially have the two characters who are both frogs who are then, thrown adrift and have to get back to where they were coming from. It's like a quest, going through the Animal Kingdom. En route, they meet a jazz alligator. They meet, various underworld characters. They have a thing that they have to perform. Magic has to be done. Songs have to be sung. Dreams dreams have to be realized. Goodness has to triumph over evil, but through in that usual process of, you know, they're going on a journey, and in the end, sometimes the journey is more important than the place you arrive at the end. So, I really loved the drawings. I really loved the fact that it was old fashioned. It was knowingly old fashioned. I love the characterizations. I mean, people have said things like, "Oh, well, it's, you know, culturally significant, first black Disney princess." I think those things are kind of less important than the fact that it's a good, solid, properly told story with lovely drawings. And take your kids to see it, because there is much to recommend it. And it really felt like old fashioned charm. And I know, I'm trying not to sound like somebody who says, "Ooh, 3D isn't good. Let's all go back to black and white silent. Ooh, Digimation isn't great. Let's all have hand-drawn animation. Let's have proper songs with instruments rather than synthesizers, blah, blah, blah." I know that's what it sounds like, but believe me, Princess and the Frog is really worth seeing, because it does stand up as a really fine piece of entertainment.
We have 5 minutes left. Here's Jade in Portsmouth.
Yes.
"Having followed the journey of the Princess and the Frog since it was announced, I couldn't wait to see it. I was not disappointed."
Please. Oh, good.
At all.
I thought you were about to say, "And I was disappointed."
"The film..." Well, as you interrupted...
Sorry.
"At that crucial moment, I was not disappointed at all. The film is entertaining, beautifully created and well written. The villain, Dr. Facilier, is very convincing, and Tiana will be an inspiration to many little girls.
Yep,
I was tapping
agree.
My feet along to the catchy Randy Newman composed songs and was left with a large smile on my face.
Good.
The film upholds the great tradition of classic hand-drawn Disney animation and introduces it to a new generation of children who have grown up with computer-generated and motion capture films."
And can I just say, if you enjoyed that, go see Ponyo as well, because Ponyo's obviously opens in a few weeks' time, and that's really great. Can I do adoration quickly? Or
Graham says, "Last week you had the chance to take 2- and 4-year-old to see the new Disney Princess and the Frog. What a contribution to the 2D, 3D debate. The characters were engaging. The story, while simple, held the kids' attention. Hard with a 2-year-old. Music toe-tapping, classic Disney fare, and the visuals. Simply stunning, absolutely beautiful, immersing if you in the world that they've created in a way that I just can't imagine working in 3D, etc."
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the problem is not Digimation. The problem is 3D, because obviously Toy Story was completely engrossing, and that is a Digimation, but, you know.
3.5 minutes to
very
go.
Quickly in that case. Adoration, Atomic Goyen. I'm a huge fan of Atomic Goyen's, and, you know, I've loved him since, I mean, obviously The Sweet Hereafter is the thing that everybody remembers, but I really, really like Exotica. I mean, I think he's a terrific filmmaker, Canadian-Armenian. However, when he started out, he made very kind of wordy films, ideas films. There's one called Speaking Parts, which kind of the title tells you what you need to know. In Adoration, the story, which is very, very speaky, is Arsene Kanjian is a French and drama teacher who has a pupil who they come across a news story about somebody who attempts to put his pregnant wife on an aeroplane with a bomb. She is stopped at at the customs check, so she doesn't get on the plane. So the child is therefore born. And the drama French teacher encourages this student to tell that story as if it happened to him. He then tells it online, and people begin to believe that he really is the child of the mother who was put on the plane by the wannabe terrorist. And it actually turns out that, strangely enough, although that isn't true, there are things in his own childhood and past which somehow make him think that his parents had a peculiar relationship in which, you know, killing and death may have featured.
And
no, well, the problem with it is, get on with it is exactly the point. I saw this at Cannes, not this year, last year. And my comment at the time was, it was almost as if Atomic Goyen had forgotten how to make a film. What he'd done was he'd sat down and written out a very complicated argument about loyalties, about religion, about cultural differences, about affiliations, which if you read it as a written script, would pretty much do everything the film had. But he'd forgotten how to make a film, which was amazing when you look at somebody who had the visual sense to make Exotica, to make Sweet Hereafter, to make... I mean, he's worked with Colin Firth, incidentally, and we should have brought that up.
Colin Firth, who's on next week.
Who's on next week. And then I said at the time, I think Atomic Goyen has made his first forgettable film. I then forgot that I'd seen Adoration, and then it was coming around this time, and I said, I need to see the new Atomic Goyen film, and I started watching, and I was 10 minutes into it before I realised that it was the film that I had seen in Cannes a year and a bit ago, and said, it's as if Atomic Goyen has forgotten how to make a film, and it's his first forgettable film. So, on every level, QED. I mean, you need to see everything Atomic Goyen has ever made, obviously. But it's,
I don't think I do, really.
I would be very hard pressed to recommend Adoration as anything other than a really interesting idea by a filmmaker who is not making a film. And it's like Atom. I know since then he's made something else, which is I hope is much, much better. But it was really bizarre to see somebody with such a visual sense, with such a sense of cinema, with such a, at his best, a sparkling sort of Cronenbergian sense of the visual,
yes.
to have completely yes. forgotten how yes. to look.
Annette, Nathan, Simon, wouldn't it be great if this weekend you could say something like, and then Jermaine Defoe came on ex nihilo and scored the winner? It's unlikely, given his current form, as Mark would often point out. Yeah. Movie of the week.
Princess and the Frog.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Splendid. Princess and the Frog it is. Thanks very much indeed for watching, if this has been your experience in the afternoon. Thanks very much indeed for listening. We're back next week in our more conventional role with special guest Colin Firth.
Yes, he'll be great. I have a feeling he'll be great.
Thanks for downloading from the BBC. To find other downloads or more information, go online.
bbc.co.uk/5live.
You can get more of my film reviews, anecdotes and opinions by visiting my uncut blog. Head to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode.